www.ccl.org.
Good morning. Welcome to Radioactivity. I'm Rob Lurie. Well, coming up, you might see picket lines in some of the Bay Area, in front of some of the Bay Area hospitals tomorrow as nurses protest short staffing at some of those hospitals. We're going to find out more later in the program. And algae is clogging the giant Lake Okeechobee in the center part of the state. It's causing problems on both coasts and has the governor declaring a state of emergency. We'll talk with the leading scientists about the cause of the algae blooms in a moment. But first, three listener comments about yesterday's interview with the president of one of the nation's leading anti-abortion groups, Americans United for Life. Here's what three listeners had to say.
Yes, I'd like to make a comment about the program on abortion. We need to keep abortion legal because it's not fair to a woman who finds herself pregnant and doesn't know what to do. And she has to end the pregnancy either through financial reasons or for other reasons. I don't know, because 30 years ago, I was in that very same position. I had a choice between keeping my job or getting on welfare. I chose to keep my job, so I'd be a taxpayer. And I'm pretty sure there's a lot of other women that are in the same situation that I'm in. And a poor woman that's forced to have a child is just going to abuse the kid. You heard the story about the little girl off the bridge? That's one story. One time a kid was thrown into the trash. One kid was stuffed in a cooler, and all the other stories that no one even knows about, those are some of the worst things that could happen. So what's so bad about abortion? If a kid is going to wind up getting killed anyhow, it doesn't make any sense.
I was just listening to the show on abortion, and this is a slippery slope. Personally, I believe that abortion is morally wrong. There's lots of things in our country that are illegal that are morally wrong. But women should have the legal right to be able to do it. And it is a financial exigent for women to do it because they cannot financially bring that child into this world and support it. Now, it is conservative policies in our system that force women into abortion. In other words, if we had maternity care, we had a $15 to $17 an hour living wage, we had national education, national dental care, these programs, maternal care, would be so critical for women because if a woman does get pregnant, that while she's having that baby, she's able to draw on an income. And then if she decides she wants to go to college and be a nurse or be a technician or an engineer or whatever, she can. So I believe that abortion would drastically be reduced. I'd probably say about 75% if it wasn't for conservative policies.
In reference to the Mrs. Foster interview today on Tuesday, I found her to be an emotionless weasel, as she was trained in law school, and was not about to let you get to her. Her responses were consistently cool, nearly in a consciously practiced sociopathic way. That is what makes her so effective. You did as good a job as possible without outright doing what a Hannity would have done by insulting her. This is Ron in Sarasota.
Some listener comments about yesterday's program. Well, over the last month, blue-green algae has spread across Lake Okeechobee, which sits in the middle of the state between Fort Myers and West Palm Beach. By last week, as water circulated counterclockwise, 90% of the 370-square-mile lake was filled with foul green slime. Smelly water looking like a rancid smoothie also flowed down the Caloosahatchee River toward the southwest coast of Florida. In some areas, two toxic subspecies of the algae were detected. The Treasure Coast on the east side of the state is now bracing for the same, with the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers expected to open the gates in the coming days as part of its regular wet season plan to keep Okeechobee lake levels down and protect the lake's aging dike. The problem has gone on for years. It kills fish, hurts tourism and outdoor recreation. It lowers property values and in some cases makes people sick. Here to talk about the giant algae bloom is Dr. Paul Gray, the science coordinator with the Everglades Restoration Program of Audubon of Florida. And Dr. Gray, welcome to WMNF. Great to have you here.
Thanks very much, and thanks for that great description of my poor lake.
How close are you to the lake right now?
Pardon?
Do you live close to the lake?
I work in the watershed. I live actually about 30 miles from Lake Okeechobee. I live up along the Kissimmee River, but yeah, that's my main job is to work on Lake Okeechobee and trying to get it into better shape in the future.
Okay, so I've not been there this year. What can you have you been there, and what's it look like?
Well, the lake is huge. For people who haven't been there, it's about 30 to 35 miles across, depending on which way you're going. And if you go out into the middle of it in a boat, you can't see shore in any direction. And the odd thing is it may only be 8 feet deep underneath you. It's just really, really shallow. And about one-third of the lake is vegetated. It's marshes and full of reeds and grasses and submerged grasses. And it's kind of a funny thing that when they talk about 90% of the lake being covered with algae bloom, they're talking about that middle open water area, and they're not talking about the marsh. And the marsh, right now, if you go back into it, it has clear water. The water's clean because those plants back there keep the algae out, and they use up the nutrients rather than the algae. So at the same time, we have this horrible problem in the middle of the lake with the toxic algae. The marshes can be healthy and full of birds and full of fish, and it's hard from a PR standpoint to remind people that even though the lake's got problems, it's also got a lot of really great values remaining.
So this isn't the first time this happens. This happens over and over again. What causes the algae blooms in Lake Okeechobee?
Yeah, the first really big algae blooms that the lake got were back in the 1980s. And it was because we've been putting too much phosphorus into the lake. phosphorus and nitrogen both are fertilizers. And in freshwater systems, phosphorus tends to be the one that triggers algae blooms. And basically, the lake used to have phosphorus levels at about 40 parts per billion. And once it got above 50, it started getting algae blooms. And nowadays, the lake stays between 100 and 200. And all that phosphorus is just from human activity and pollution. And we've been trying to clean it up for 40 years unsuccessfully, and until we do, we're going to continue to have these problems.
Talk about the plumbing of the lake. Where does the phosphorus, how does the phosphorus enter the lake?
Okay, so the lake's watershed actually starts right at the Orlando International Airport. Boggy Creek and Reedy Creek flow out of that area, and it's 100 miles down to Lake Okeechobee, and so all the human activity in the watershed from the cities and from the farms and from everything ends up draining into the lake. And, you know, we talk about the deep water in the lake and the estuary dumps, and, you know, not only they don't want the fresh water, but they certainly don't want fresh water full of toxic algae. And the dumps and the algae really are not the problems. They're the symptoms of this watershed's been heavily drained and it's been heavily polluted, and all that water goes into the lake and creates these problems. And so in order to fix it, we've got to go north of Lake Okeechobee and start storing water and cleaning water, and we just haven't done that yet.
I've been to Disney World a bunch of times. It's always lushly landscaped. Is that landscaping, is that fertilized heavily, and does Disney World contribute at all to the problem in Lake Okeechobee?
Yeah, that's actually a good question. Disney World and the Orlando area, actually the water quality up there is better than it is down next to the lake. And the water that comes out of Lake Kissimmee that goes into the Kissimmee River tends to be about 70 parts per billion phosphorus. And by the time it gets in the lake, it's about 180 parts per billion. So most of the pollution is going in right around the rim of the lake. And most of that's from from agriculture. There's dairies, there's citrus groves, there's ranch lands. And all combined, those guys have a pretty big phosphorus load that comes off them. And there's also been some, oddly enough, the lower East Coast cities, Miami, Fort Lauderdale, West Palm Beach, for years they have been hauling their human solid waste up to the Okeechobee watershed and dumping it. That's how they get rid of their human waste stream. And so a lot of those cities actually have contributed to Lake Okeechobee's pollution too. So it's a lot of human activity. It's not just the farmers. It's not just the cities. It's pretty much all of us that have done this.
And you said, too, the wetlands between the Orlando International Airport and Lake Okeechobee have been changed. How has the Kissimmee River and how have the wetlands been changed over the years in that area just north of the lake?
Yeah, so the Kissimmee River is the biggest inflow to the lake, and in the 1960s, we dug a great big canal down the middle of the floodplain and drained all the wetlands. And what that did was, historically, you know, we have this wet season that we're having right now, and all this water would fall in the Kissimmee Valley, and it would sit there for months because there wasn't a very efficient drainage system, and it would slowly meander to the lake. And when it did, it would get cleaned by all the wetlands and stuff in between. Well, once we dug that big Kissimmee River ditch and some other big canals in the watershed, basically the water, as soon as it lands in the watershed, it just races to the lake. And so, like, after Hurricane Irma, the lake went up 3.5 feet in just 1 month. And in a pristine watershed, it probably would have gone up 1 or 2 feet in the first month, and then all that water would have taken 6 months to get into the lake. And so that's the first problem, is that the extensive drainage system just races the water right into the lake, and when it does, it doesn't get cleaned by anything, and it makes the lake deep, and then it harms the lake, and then we dump it down the estuary, and it harms the estuaries. And so that drainage is the first step in really why we have such a big problem with the lake nowadays.
Is there an effort to restore the meandering flow of the Kissimmee River and also restore some of the wetlands?
Yeah, so that's the good news. As soon as we got done messing up the Kissimmee River, people realized that was not a good idea. And so right now, the Corps and the state are almost finished restoring a large part of the river floodplain, and they're filling in the big canal, and the river is reflooding. And actually, it makes me really happy because it's only 4 miles from my house, and I can go down there and enjoy this beautiful river again. And it's funny because it's an ecological restoration project, but what it does is it slows the water down, and it runs through the marshes, and it gets cleaner. And so that project, even though we're trying to restore the health and the ecology of the river, is actually helping Lake Okeechobee, because we don't have water glugging in quite as fast, and when it does go into the lake, it's cleaner. And as good as that project is, it still only covers like about 4% of the entire watershed. And so what we're trying to do is go through the whole watershed and work with landowners and say, hey, can we pay you to store water in your property, you know, plug your drainage ditches, and when it rains, let your wetlands fill up and let them be habitat again, and let that water sit there for a few months as it slowly goes to the lake. And we've just barely started on that, so we don't have a lot of progress, but until we start storing more water north of the lake and slowing down the water movement, we're going to continue to have these problems.
We're talking with Dr. Paul Gray, Ph.D., science coordinator with the Everglades Restoration Program of the Audubon Society of Florida, and you're listening to WMNF in Tampa. We're talking about the huge algae bloom in Lake Okeechobee that is threatening to disrupt recreation and fishing on both coasts. Well, one of the problems with the lake, Dr. Gray, is that there's a dike at the bottom of the lake, in the south end of the lake, and it's old, and people fear what could happen if that dike were to breach.
Right. So there's a big dike. It goes all the way around the lake. It's about 35 to 40 feet tall, and it holds the lake in. And it's just basically a dirt pile. They dug a ditch and they piled it up, and so it holds the water in the lake, but it leaks. And so they've actually had some leaks when the lake was deep that were so bad that they started eroding through the dike, and they made a sinkhole all the way to the top of the dike. And had they not found the leak and patched it, it would have collapsed the dike, and we would have had massive flooding downstream of the lake. So the Corps is very conscious of this. They're spending what we think is going to be $1.8 billion to try to put a sleeve down the middle of the dike. It's basically a concrete wall that will go 30 feet under the ground and be about 2 feet wide, and try to stop those leaks from being so bad. It's not going to be a perfect fix, and they're also replacing a lot of structures around the dike, too, that are old and subject to failure. It's not going to be a perfect fix, but at least it will make the dike safer in the future. And the Corps just announced the other day that they are going to allocate $500 million to try to get that done as soon as we can. Because right now, you know, the lake's at 14.5 feet, and they think if it gets to 18 feet, that's when you really start getting the leakage problems that could actually collapse the dike. And if you think about us being at 14.5 feet, and Irma raised the lake 3.5 feet in 1 month, well, if Irma comes in now, we would be at 18 feet. And so that's the level that no one wants to be at. So, again, it's really important for the Corps to try to reinforce the dike. But it's never going to really be completely safe. It's just going to be safer. So,
And we've got almost three more months of the rainy season to go, too, hurricane season and the rainy season.
Yeah, and, you know, the colonel for the Corps of Engineers knows how badly the estuaries are getting wrecked and how badly the lake's getting wrecked by this deep water. But you don't want to be the colonel right now, because just as you said, there's 3 months left in the hurricane season, and we're already at 14 and a half feet, and we're just one storm away from getting up to levels that no one wants to be at, and there's just nothing we can do about that. And it gets back to this idea that we need to build more water storage somewhere besides Lake Okeechobee, and a lot of it's going to be north of the lake. They've proposed a big reservoir and some wells. Nelson? No, not Nelson. From the East Coast, but
Brian Mast?
No, I can't believe.
Sorry. No, well, you'll remember it in a second. I know it's because
The EAA reservoir. They're going to build a big reservoir south of the lake to try to have a pop off valve. So when the lake gets too deep, rather than dump it down the estuaries, we can send it to that reservoir in the Everglades agricultural area. And so we're just trying to build these reservoirs. They're also building two reservoirs, one on the east side of the lake and one on the west side of the lake, because like last week, the Corps actually stopped all the releases to the Caloosahatchee from Lake Okeechobee, but they got big rainstorms in their own watershed, and they still had harmful releases going on. So, you know, we just have drainage and pollution problems all across Florida, and we're going to have to rebuild this water management system to try to help slow that down.
Well, by restoring the Kissimmee River, would the flow into the lake be really reduced if the Kissimmee is meandering now and more slowly going into Lake Okeechobee, or are we likely to see the pressure on that dike for the foreseeable future?
Yeah, the Kissimmee River project does reduce it. And, you know, what we talk about Everglades restoration, and people don't really know what that means, but it's basically 60-some projects that are all through the Everglades region, both north of the lake and south and east and west. And all of them are needed to try to get our water management system back into a more manageable situation. And so any one project doesn't really get you there. But you got to do all 60 of them before we really have a system that's going to be under some reasonable level of control and serve our needs. So people talk about the Kissimmee River restoration or Lake Okeechobee Watershed Project or the EAA Reservoir, and they say, well, that's not big enough to fix everything. And it's not, but it's one step in a journey that we have to take if we're ever going to get this South Florida more livable.
The big fear for folks on the West Coast over here and on the East Coast is the release of the water into the canals to the east and west of Lake Okeechobee that contains this algae, this toxic algae. What's in that algae? What makes it so toxic, and how bad is it when they release it from Lake Okeechobee?
Yeah, so the toxins, it's called cyanobacteria, and they produce the toxins because they don't want to get eaten by zooplankton, and so they make themselves poisonous. Just like a poison mushroom or like a pine tree, you know, you don't want to eat a pine tree because of all the pine pitch. And so when they do that, you know, that helps protect them from getting eaten, but then those toxins also are harmful to, they get in the water column, and like if your pets drink the water, they can actually get killed. Low-level exposure can cause liver problems and other types of issues. And basically, back when Okeechobee was only 40 parts per billion phosphorus in a more, you know, pristine state, the cyanobacteria don't have enough phosphorus in those conditions, and they don't really bloom. They've always been there, but they don't have enough fuel to really take off. And when we get the phosphorus levels up to 100 like they are now, that's enough fuel for them to really go have their blooms and become super abundant. And again, that gets back to, we got to clean our water and get it back down to 40 parts per billion, or we're going to continue to have these cyanobacteria blooms. And again, you don't want to be the colonel, because he's worried about the safety of the dike. He's worried about the dike breaking. But he knows if he opens the gates and dumps the water out to try to keep the lake from getting too deep, that he's sending toxic cyanobacteria down to the coast. And that's, you know, you just don't have any good choices there. And it's really sad that we've let it get this far. But again, you know, we have Everglades restoration projects, and we can fix this. We've just got to get serious about it and spend the money and do it.
And when that toxic water, that polluted water, is released from Lake Okeechobee, we've seen massive fish kills on both, especially on the East Coast, but also on the West Coast.
Right, and the fish can be killed two ways. One is if the toxins get so abundant they can actually kill the fish and other things, you know, clams and oysters. But the other way is the algae blooms, when there's so many algae, sometimes you'll have a cloudy day and a lot of them will die. And as they start to decompose, they use up all the oxygen and you get a fish kill that way too. So it's just there's a lot of bad things that happen when we start having blooms.
Well, our guest is Dr. Paul Gray. He's with the Everglades Restoration Program of Audubon, Florida. He's the science coordinator, and you're listening to WMNF in Tampa. Our phone number is 813-239-9663, and our email address is dj@wmnf.org. You talked about the causes, and you said one of the biggest causes is the dairy, the citrus, and the cattle right around the lake, the rim of the lake. Let me just ask about sugar real quickly before we get into dairy, citrus, and cattle. Does the sugar that's grown near the lake, does that contribute to the phosphorus levels?
Yes. Again, it's everybody. Now, most of the sugar is grown south of the lake, so it doesn't actually directly, the water that comes off their fields doesn't usually go into the lake. But there actually are a lot more sugar grown north of the lake now, too. But again, it's not the individual crops that are causing the pollution. It's just human activity. And so one of the things we're trying to do with all the different agricultural sectors, and urban, actually, is get them to do best management practices. And that's doing things like fencing off waterways so the cows don't go out there and poop right in the stream and have it flow off their property, trying to use lower amounts of fertilizer, trying to recycle water rather than have it flow off your property, catch in a retention pond, and then reuse it, and that way your pollution doesn't leave your property. And those best management practices actually work, but unfortunately we haven't really gotten funding for them. And so, you know, when we try to help people fence off their waterways or do other things that they need to reconfigure their farms, we just haven't been able to cost share with private landowners, and so we haven't gotten as much out of best management practices as we need to. And again, that's one of the things that in our phosphorus control programs we really need to do a lot better, and we haven't done well enough yet.
Are the dairy people and the citrus people and the cattle people pretty cooperative, would you say, in recognizing their impact on Lake Okeechobee?
Moderately. You know, it costs a lot of money to do some of the things we want them to do. So that gets back to the cost share. It's okay, we'll pay for part of it. And like the dairy industry is famous for polluting the lake. And back in the 1980s, the phosphorus levels coming out of the dairy basin were 1,000 parts per billion. That's what was going into the lake. And remember, the goal for the lake's 40, and they were at 1,000.
Wow.
And, yeah, so we did a big dairy buyout, and we helped some of them reconfigure their properties and recycle their water. And, you know, and the good news is that basin now is no longer at 1,000. It's at 500. But the bad news is we still need to get it down to 40. So that's kind of the story of our progress, is we've made some progress, but we've still got a long way to go.
I've heard some politicians, I'm not going to name them because you're not a political guy, but I've heard some politicians say all we have to do is fix the dike and everything's going to be okay.
Yeah. The lake's pretty complicated at how it works, and so a lot of people don't understand it, but that's kind of why I emphasize that the deep water and the algae are not the problem, they're the symptom. And they're a symptom of an overdrained and polluted watershed. And so nothing we do inside of the Hoover Dike is going to fix these problems. We've got to go upstream into the watershed where our farms and cities are and work with them to try to slow down their water flow and clean their water. Actually, it's Senator Negron from the Treasure Coast who helped get that agricultural or the reservoir in the EAA. I finally remembered it.
Okay. I was looking at my email this morning, and Congressman Brian Mast put out a press release. He's the congressman in the 18th District of Florida on the East Coast, and he's saying that after water tested positive for toxins 15 times more toxic than the World Health Organization considers safe for human contact, Congressman Mast took to the floor of the House of Representatives to call for a federal emergency declaration for Florida over the conditions in Lake Okeechobee. He did this yesterday. What do you make of that?
Congressman Mast has been really good and really strong on this. And actually, he came over to Okeechobee and went out on the lake in our airboat with us just to find out what he could. And I just really appreciate his making noise, because like I mentioned, you know, we're going to need money to do projects. And unfortunately, when you get algae blooms, that's what everybody pays attention and you have a chance to get it. But he's really trying to get funds and get things going. You know, the phosphorus problem and the drainage have been 100 years in the making. And the frustrating thing for most people is when you look at how long and how much we got to do to fix this, it's actually a lot of work. And it's going to take a long time. But, you know, if we don't get started on it, this is just going to be our life. And I don't think anybody in Florida wants to live like this. I think we want to have clean water and be able to swim and fish and not worry about all these things. So I just really appreciate his efforts.
Well, over the last month, just to remind our listeners, blue-green algae has spread across Lake Okeechobee, which sits in the middle of the state between Fort Myers and West Palm Beach. By last week, as water circulated in the lake, 90% of the 370-square-mile lake was filled with foul green slime. And we're talking about how to fix that problem with Dr. Paul Gray, the science coordinator with the Everglades Restoration Program of Audubon of Florida. And you're listening to WMNF in Tampa, 88.5 FM. So there is hope, but things are not proceeding as quickly as you would like. Let me ask you about the water management districts. Do they have a role, and could they be more forceful in protecting Lake Okeechobee?
Yes, so we have the South Florida Water Management District, and their jurisdiction goes all the way up to Orlando, and it covers the whole Okeechobee watershed. And so they're very active in all these restoration programs. But again, it gets back to funding. They have reduced their staff recently, and they don't have as much money as they used to, yet we want them to build all these reservoirs and filter marshes that clean water and do other things. So until we start getting more funding for them to be able to do as many projects as we want them to do, progress is going to be slow.
Joe writes in via email. He says, why not just send the water from Lake Okeechobee into the Everglades, over the dike and into the Everglades? Talk about that for a moment.
He's exactly right. That's where all the water used to go, and that's where we need to get it to go again. Right now, the water coming out of the EAA and out of Okeechobee are too polluted, and if we put them into the Everglades like they are, it would turn the Everglades into a big cattail thicket, which would essentially destroy the Everglades. So they've built tens of thousands of acres of filter marshes on the south end of the agricultural area to treat the water before it goes into the Everglades, and it's more treatment wetlands than anywhere in the whole world. Again, this is one of those things where, in spite of how many problems we have, we've actually done a lot of different things to try to catch up. And there's a limit to how much water those treatment wetlands can filter. So we're trying to build more of them. We're trying to get more water storage so we can send the water slower to them, because being biological systems, they can only treat the water so fast. You know, plants only grow so fast. So we're working on that, and that is the ultimate goal. Since when we get water in Okeechobee, rather than dump it down the estuaries, we need to send it back to the Everglades. And there's a funny thing about that, too, because the Everglades are the source of the Biscayne Aquifer, and the Biscayne Aquifer is where Miami and Lauderdale and the Palm Beaches, one-third of all Floridians drink their water from the Biscayne Aquifer. And so all this water we're dumping down to the estuaries and wasting harmfully, if we put it back in the Everglades, that's going to be the water supply future of the Lower East Coast. So even for people who don't care about birds and fish, you know, we're also trying to fix our water supply going into the future for Florida.
Doctor, do you have a few minutes to take a few phone calls?
Yeah, I'd be happy to.
All right, let's go to David in Tampa, who has a question about growth. David, you're on with Dr. Paul Gray.
Hi. One thing I was thinking about with Orlando is there's no natural boundaries for development, kind of like you do in Tampa with the Bay, you know, and is that out-of-control development making things worse? Because, you know, there's even talk of making the ranch there in Osceola County into a huge development, and that might make things even worse with more fertilizer and more phosphorus.
Yeah, you're exactly right. Human population growth just has the specter of making things worse. And actually, you kind of reminded me of Tampa Bay. I mean, 20 and 30 years ago, your bay was really polluted. You'd lost a lot of seagrasses. I mean, it was a big mess. And these same types of programs that I'm talking about that we need to do in the inland, you guys started doing there. And actually, you have more seagrasses in your bay right now than you had decades ago. And so that gets back to the idea that even though people are here, and even though we have cities, as long as we learn to manage our water better, we can still protect our natural systems and have them be healthy. So, again, this just gets to all of us being aware of good ways to do things and bad ways to do things. And we know that growth is inevitable, but we need to require new developments to manage our water right and to store water and not be polluters.
All right, David, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
You know, I saw something horrible the other day. I saw a guy fertilizing his lawn during a rainstorm up here in the Tampa Bay area, and I wanted to go do a citizen's arrest, but I was too polite to do that.
A lot of municipalities have issued fertilizer ordinances, and they say, you know, don't fertilize during the rainy season because it just runs right off your property. So those little things and big things. We need to do a lot of things to try to protect our waterways.
Now, Lou writes this question. What happened to buying the sugar fields? If I remember correctly, Governor Crist gave them $500 million, and we were to give them another $500 million several years ago to buy them out for the purpose of draining the lake into the sugar fields and then filter it through the Everglades. But Governor Scott said he wasn't going to pay the balance. So bring us up to date. Is that close to being true, what Lou wrote, or you know?
Yeah, Governor Crist realized that we had these big water storage needs, and Everglades Restoration always had an idea of building reservoirs down there to try to catch water out of the lake and store it during wet periods, and then we'd have it left over during dry periods. And so U.S. Sugar did agree to sell, and they were working on the deal, and then in 2008, of course, we had the big recession start, and suddenly we didn't have as much money as we did. And then we got a change in the governor's mansion, and so the new governor didn't have that interest. But what Senator Negron's reservoir in the EAA, which recently got approval by Congress, that's still the same idea. Now, people are worried that what we have on the books right now is not going to be big enough to meet all of our needs, and that may well be so, but at least it's a step in the right direction, and if we need more later, we can build another reservoir. But yeah, that's exactly the idea. Is we need, you know, the funny thing too is we dump all this water out of Okeechobee, and like in 2004 and 5, we dumped enough water out of the lake to meet 6 years of water supply for all the farmers around the lake. That's how much we wasted. The following year, we were in a drought, and they were getting rationed by 50%. And it's because, you know, we get plenty of water, but we just throw it away. And so we have a system right now that doesn't work for the lakes. It doesn't work for the estuaries. It doesn't work for the farmers. The cities on the Lower East Coast are worried about their future water supply for just drinking water. So, again, rebuilding the water management system not only helps our environment, but it helps human life, too.
Let's take a call from Amy in St. Petersburg. Amy, you're on the air with Dr. Paul Gray.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I'm not sure if you already covered it or not, is the stormwater runoff from all the golf courses in the state of Florida. And I think that, you know, a lot could be done legislatively to have the golf courses maintain, you know, a drainage system around their golf courses to contain their chemicals from the golf course and put it back into their own type of recycling system and process it. That's where I'm going.
Yeah, well, that's a good question. Doctor, what would you say about golf courses? Are they one of the heavy contributors of the phosphorus?
Yes, Amy's exactly right. You know, they're very carefully manicured and very highly maintained, and they also have been a source of a lot of pesticides and fertilizers and other things. And just like I talked about best management practices for farms, golf courses also need to have those and recycle their water. You know, they have water traps, and so if they can keep the water in their water traps and not let it flow off their property, that really helps the rest of us. But once again, it's another human enterprise that we just have to manage correctly, or it's going to be a big problem for us.
And Dr. Gray, didn't the Audubon Society certify certain golf courses as being more sustainable than others? Wasn't there a program that the Audubon Society had a few years ago?
Yeah, actually, that's a group called Audubon International.
Oh, okay.
From our Audubon, and that's caused some confusion. But yeah, they were doing a program like that to try to get golf courses to have best management practices.
Well, Amy, I think thank you for the great question.
All right, thanks.
All right. And let's go to Sam in Tampa, who wants to know if we could use the algae for fuel. Is that right, Sam?
Yes, sir. So I saw this interesting documentary, I guess a news story on Vice. The project was called the California Salt and Saw Biomass Remediation Project, where they had a lot of runoff from factories and pesticides and whatnot, creating algae in certain lakes or bodies of water. And what they were doing is that they had a government-sponsored project where they were able to turn the algae into fuel. I was just wondering, is that something you guys have heard of, considered, or even is it even remotely relatable to the subject?
All right. Great question, Sam. Thanks a lot. Doctor, what would you say?
Yeah, Sam's on the right track. There's actually quite a few people trying to figure out economical systems to do that. Because once again, you know, these nutrients, they're fertilizers. They're worth something. And so there are people who are trying to grow algae and learn how to harvest it and then convert it into fuel like methanol and stuff like that. We don't really have big prototypes that everybody's bought into yet, but there are people working on that, and hopefully if they can do that, we can start taking this polluted water and use it as a benefit rather than just a problem.
And Dr. Gray, if this algae is toxic to fish, and we've seen a lot of fish kills, what happens if when a human touches the algae? Is it also dangerous to the human touch?
It can be. Some of these toxins can actually absorb through your skin, or if you have a cut, obviously they could get in there. So, you know, the rule of thumb is if you see a green scum on a water body, just don't touch it. Don't get near it and go somewhere else. Not all the green scums have the toxins in them, but, you know, just it's better to be safe than sorry.
Let's go to Derek, who's in Port Charlotte, who might be an eyewitness to some of this. Derek, you're on. What's your question?
Doctor, about 10 years ago, I'm a professional land surveyor, and I was involved in a study on the Indian Reservation where we cross-sectioned all of the canals coming into the Indian Reservation and from the north and the south going out. And the plan was to direct a lot of the water out of Okeechobee through the canal system into the Indian Reservation because they found out that the water that was going through the reservation was coming out cleaner on the south end because of, you know, the non-growth that was going on the reservation. And I was just wondering, whatever happened to that plan?
That's down the Big Cypress?
Yes.
Yeah, they're still trying to work on that. One of the problems is that we don't have a very efficient canal network to get the water from Okeechobee over to them. But again, you know, here we have all this water that is a problem right now, and they need water, and they want water. And so that's, you know, one of the many things in everybody's restoration that we're trying to reroute water. You know, not only do we need to store it and clean it, but we need to send it to the right spot when the time comes. So it's good that they're trying to do those types of projects. And, you know, obviously when you have someone who wants to help you, you should try to get you should try to figure out a way to let that help happen. So that's still in the books. That's still something that they want to do, and hopefully we can figure out a way to do it.
Okay.
All right. Derek, thanks a lot. Thanks for calling. Derek, have you seen anything? Okay, he left. We're talking about the toxic algae bloom in Lake Okeechobee with Dr. Paul Gray, who is the science coordinator with the Everglades Restoration Program of Audubon of Florida. And here's an anonymous email. The person asks, some homeowners association force their members to weed and feed their lawns or face a fine. Should this requirement be waived in order to protect the environment?
your listeners know the problem. that's a frustration to a lot of us. And I've even had friends who are trying to plant native flowers for pollinators and trying to, you know, make their yard more eco-friendly and actually are ordered not to. That is a homeowners association issue. Nobody on the outside can really tell them what to do because if you join one, then they have their own rules. But this is something, one more thing that we need to work on and let people have healthier yards and use less pollution. But that again, it ends up, you know, you have to fight your own homeowners association to get those changes.
Let's go to Mike in Asheville, North Carolina. Mike, you're on. What's your question?
Thanks to both of you. Great show. I would like to ask the guest if the water from the lake is too polluted to release into the glades, then why right now is 1.2 billion gallons per day being dumped into the St. Lucie River through the canal system. I mean, I have friends that live in that area, which happens to be, as far as Florida goes, one of the least populated beach areas. The estuaries there used to be incredible for fishing. Now the people all have to go offshore or else they face algae within those very same estuaries. How are they getting away with it?
All right, Mike, thanks for the question. Thanks. Doctor, what would you say?
Mike's exactly right. This is extraordinarily unfair. And what happened is we had the big hurricanes. Well, there were two of them in the Everglades in the 1920s that drowned several thousand people from storm surge out of the lake. And they started building the dike to protect against that. But in the 1940s, we had extraordinarily wet hurricanes, and it just flooded everything from Miami to Orlando. And that's when we designed the present water management system we have. We call it the Central and Southern Flood Control District or something like that, CNSF. And the plan was to drain the state. And so the Corps engineers knew that from Okeechobee to Florida Bay is 100 miles, but from Okeechobee to the St. Lucie estuary on the Atlantic coast is only about 35. And so from an engineering perspective, it was much more efficient to just dig a great big canal to just run it east and then another big canal to run it west. And so they built the system like that, and if you go to the St. Lucie locks, it's a huge structure with all kinds of gates and a lot of capacity and a big canal. And if you go around to the south end of the lake, you see the structures that go out there, and they're real small. They're dinky little things. And so even if we wanted to, we don't have the structures big enough to roll the water south like we wish we could. And so that's part of Everglades restoration is reconfiguring the structures that we can move more water south rather than east and west. And so right now, you know, again, the colonel doesn't like the choices that he has because he has to dump the water east and west, and he can't actually send it south yet, but we're trying to build the infrastructure to be able to do that. So, you know, unfortunately, that's just the way the system was designed, and those guys really got picked on. I mean, having everybody dump all their water on them is just really not fair.
Well, Dr. Gray, we're almost out of time. I want to ask you, what else should we be talking about here in terms of giving hope for the restoration of Lake Okeechobee? What other things should I have asked you about that I didn't ask you about, or what other things would you like to raise so that the audience needs to know about this toxic algae bloom in the lake?
I think it's just we need funding to do the projects we need to do. We need to work with all the landowners to try to get them to clean up their act as well as they can. We need to build these reservoirs. We need to build filter marshes. We need to talk to homeowners about fertilizing in rainstorms and golf course managers about, you know, how much stuff they use on their properties. And, you know, it's not really just an Okeechobee problem or an estuary problem. It's something that's happening all through Florida. And just like Tampa Bay was able to do work in their own watershed and help protect their bay, we still have more work to do. And it's just about everybody becoming conscious that it's not okay to pollute our waterways. And it's funny, I work for the Audubon Society, and we got started about 120 years ago, partly over the cause of people were shooting the wading birds, the herons and egrets, and plucking their feathers out and using them in hats. We didn't think that was okay. And it took decades to get laws passed and to get people to stop doing that. And nowadays, you know, everybody thinks that that's not okay. You don't shoot a bird and just put its feather in your hat. And I think with water quality, it's that same kind of society needs to start telling people it's not okay for you, whoever you are, wherever you are, to pollute our water. You have to be a responsible citizen. And I think we'll get there, but we're not there yet. So I just, you know, I hope all of your listeners can just be conscious of that. And when we have projects that are going to try to improve our waterways, that we vote to fund them, and we tell our representatives in Congress and the legislature that, you know, clean water is important to us, and we want to have it all through Florida.
Dr. Paul Gray, thank you so much for being here. If people want to contact you, maybe invite you to speak at their community event, or if they want to find out more, how can they do that?
My email is pgray, P-G-R-A-Y, at Audubon, which is AUDUBON.org. And I do come talk to people about Okeechobee or the Everglades or birds or different things. Some of the talks are fun. Some of them are kind of like this where you have problems and you're trying to figure out how to deal with them.
Well, it's one of the treasures of Florida, and I'm glad you're working on it. Dr. Paul Gray, thank you so much for being on WMNF.
Well, thanks for having me, and I listen to your show when I can get it. I'm right on the edge of your viewing, so I enjoy your show. So thank you.
Thanks, Paul. Great to talk to you, and we'll have you back.
All right. Thanks, Rob.
Take care. Bye-bye. That's Dr. Paul Gray, and you can find him at pgray@audubon, AUDUBON.org. Well, you're listening to WMNF in Tampa, 88.5 FM. Tomorrow morning, registered nurses at HCA-affiliated hospitals in St. Petersburg, Bradenton, Sarasota, and Brooksville will hold informational pickets between 6 a.m. and 8 a.m., urging that hospital management address registered nurse turnover rates and make sure the hospitals are adequately staffed. This morning, I spoke with one of those nurses who plans to take part in tomorrow's picket. She's Rose Lily Story. She's an RN who works at St. Petersburg General Hospital. Rose Lily Story, welcome to WMNF. Good to have you here.
Thank you for having me.
Now, I understand that there are going to be six separate pickets by nurses around the Tampa Bay area in St. Pete and in Bradenton and Brooksville and Sarasota, all around the Bay Area. What and you're part of the group National Nurses United. Why are you picketing?
Well, we're going to be out there tomorrow because we want to go ahead and make sure that our hospital, who's affiliated with the parent company of HCA, uses its resources to excel in our patient care.
And when you say uses its resources, are you suggesting that they're not using the resources now as much as they could for patient care?
Well, as we understand, we know that HCA did receive, as part of a beneficiary of the tax cuts earlier this year. So what we want to do is hopefully put the message out that they use some of those resources to help retain and recruit our nurses at St. Pete General Hospital. Not just St. Pete General, but the other five hospitals that will also be picketing tomorrow. And we know that if we have those resources, we can provide that excellent care that patients deserve.
So they got a tax break from the Tax Cut Act earlier this year, and you say they're not using it, they're not reinvesting it in personnel at the hospital.
Well, we have data from the hospital, actually, that was provided. For instance, at St. Pete General Hospital, that at least 52% of our patients, our nurses, have been there less than 3 years, 25% less than 18 months, and about only 11% are more than 10 years of experience. If we have the retention or the resources for the retention of our nurses and also to be able to recruit new nurses to stay, we believe that continuity of excellent care will be provided.
Why do you think there's so much turnover?
Like I said, we have excellent nurses at our hospital. We do. But we consistently need to go ahead and retain our nurses. Again, the message is that resources definitely help to retain our nurses. And that's why we feel it needs to be put out there. We care about our patients, and optimal care needs to be provided with nurses that have experience.
And Rose Lily, you work at St. Pete General. Have you talked to any of the nurses who have left, who've worked there for just a few years and then left St. Pete General, and have you asked them why they left?
We have, and again, it goes back to the same message. You know, we want to be competitive with the market. We know that nurses also have to take care of themselves. You know, insurance premiums are getting higher, and we deserve also to be able to pay for those so that we can take care of ourselves to take care of our patients. So we understand that if we can have this kind of benefit offered to our nurses, we can also provide for our patients.
So are they leaving because the pay and benefits might be better at other medical facilities?
I know that it can be better at our hospitals. I know that if we were providing that competitive edge, I believe that we would retain our nurses. Absolutely.
Yeah. What about staffing? Is there adequate staffing at these HCA hospitals?
I'll speak for the hospitals that will be doing the informational picketing tomorrow. our hospitals have staffing grids, and just by complying with it, we can provide that excellent care. But as I told you, just from the data that the hospitals provided the union, we're out of compliance with the grid for most of the time. Actually, if I can go over some numbers, in ICU, for instance, for a period of time, we were 85% out of compliance, meaning that there is a certain percentage of staff nurses that should be assigned to a certain number of patients. So what does that mean to the patient? We want to go ahead and provide that excellent care, but we also want to provide timely care. And we do if we have that compliance. So we're asking that we maintain that compliance at least as a minimum standard.
Now, you're in contract negotiations with HCA, and the other nurses who are going to be picketing tomorrow are also in contract negotiations. The contract ran out 2 months ago.
Yes.
Is the company negotiating in good faith?
We are still in negotiations, and that is still in progress, obviously, so we don't have any final answers on any of that. This also provides us an opportunity to talk to the public and show our concerns, show our main concern and our main message.
What would you say to members of the public that might have a family member going into one of these HCA hospitals that will be picketed tomorrow? What would you say to family members? Should they have any concern, or should they think twice? What are your thoughts about if staffing levels are not always at the right level? What would you say to people who might become a patient at one of these HCA hospitals?
I know our nurses, just as I do, we give 100% to our patients. When we're in that patient room with that individual patient, that's what we want to provide. All we ask is that the staffing be complied with. Compliance always definitely correlates with better patient care, excellent patient care. We do provide excellent patient care more often when we have staffing compliance.
And Rose Lilly, is there anything else that you want to add? Maybe I didn't ask the right question, but is there anything else that you want to add so that people can better understand what's going on between National Nurses United and these local HCA hospitals?
We are a National Nurses Union organization. Our ability to go ahead and represent the nurses and advocate for our patients is what's important to us. So we just happen to be speaking about HCA right now. But again, like I said, it's about our patients, and it's about our nurses giving the patient care. We do want the public to be aware that we are having those pickets tomorrow from 6 a.m. to 8 a.m. at in front of the six facilities. It will be at Northside Hospital, Osceola, Blake Hospital, Oak Hill, Doctors Hospital, and of course St. Pete General Hospital.
All right. Well, Rose Lilly, thanks for coming on WMNF.
Okay, thank you.
That was Rose Lilly's story. She's an RN who works at St. Petersburg General Hospital, and she spoke with WMNF earlier today. And those pickets go up tomorrow between 6 a.m. and 8 a.m. at some HCA hospitals here in the Tampa Bay area. I'm going to read some of these emails that have come in. You can email your comment into the studio right now at dj@wmnf.org. Gina writes regarding the first topic today. She says, if city councils can ban the sale of fertilizer, why can't it bar homeowners associations from requiring fertilizer during certain times of the year? That's Gina writing in. I was actually horrified last week when it was raining out, and I was in, I forgot which neighborhood I was in, but I saw a homeowner fertilizing his lawn just as the rain was starting. And this is, you know, well after the rainy season has started. I think a lot of communities do ban fertilizer in the summer season because a lot of that fertilizer that you put on during the summer just runs off. And frankly, your grass doesn't need fertilizer this time of year. It'll grow just fine. It's so conditions are ideal. And then Eli writes this. He says, I take care of pools here in Florida, i.e. chemical balance. And when my customers fertilize their plants around their pool area, and after a good rain, their pools will turn green or yellow from algae. We then inform the customer about the phosphate issue with their pool. We need to hold the polluters accountable, writes Eli. All right. Well, if you, thanks to Bill Grace, he was our phone producer today. If you want to comment about today's program, you can call us up at 813-238-8001 or record your comment on extension 115. And I'll play your comments back tomorrow morning at 11 o'clock. Thanks a lot for listening. This is WMNF in Tampa. Stay tuned for the latest news from National Public Radio. And Nola is out sick today. He won't be in, so we'll have a special edition of the Tom Hartman radio program. And then at 1 o'clock today, executive session, and it's back to the music at 2 o'clock this afternoon. This is WMNF Tampa-St. Petersburg.